Okay, so I love beginning with an arriving meditation. It's a really beautiful way to set ourselves up to transition from whatever we've been doing to entering this time of practice together. So I invite you to come into a posture that supports you, a posture in which your body is stable and comfortable, not rigid. Let it be soft and relaxed, but with a quality of uprightness, whether you're sitting or standing or reclining. Uprightness meaning attentiveness, wakefulness. And no matter the posture of the body, sensing how the spine grows long out of the deep low back, all the way to the crown of the head. See if you can let the shoulders drop a little bit. Give a slight tuck to the chin, which opens the back of the neck and relaxes it. And then bringing any amount of relaxation to the front of the body, the whole face, the chest, and the belly. Creating some space to breathe, creating some space for the heart. And as you come into this posture, welcoming yourself, meeting and greeting every part of you, your heart, your mind, your body, your whole being. Welcoming yourself into practice. And as each one of us welcomes ourselves into practice, we are part of a bigger welcoming, a bigger connection, the truth of our belonging. Whatever you become aware of in the body, the mind, and the heart, letting it all belong. It's whatever is here right now. And then settling into the breathing, however that's most accessible for you, wherever you notice it in the body, or perhaps just the awareness of breathing. Remembering why you're here. What is that deeper motivation for practice? Maybe allowing or inviting an intention to arise for practice today or practice over a longer time, longer view. Noticing if there's any amount of sweetness, pleasant, any amount of goodness that is arising. Goodness in the mind, goodness in the heart, any comfort in the body. Any amount, it might be tiny for you today. Let's see if there's something there. As many Buddhist texts begin, O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, remember this immeasurable innate nobility of mind, the goodness of heart. Trust it. Return to it. It is home. We'll begin with a poem. We'll end this, begin our day and end this arriving meditation with a poem from Ada Limón called Instructions on Not Giving Up. More than the fuchsia funnels breaking out of the crabapple tree, more than the neighbor's almost obscene display of cherry limbs shoving their cotton candy-colored blossoms to the slate sky of spring rains, it's the greening of the trees that really gets to me. When all the shock of white and taffy, the world's baubles and trinkets, leave the pavement strewn with the confetti of aftermath, the leaves come, patient, plodding, a green skin growing over whatever winter did to us, a return to the strange idea of continuous living despite the mess of us, the hurt, the empty. Fine then, I'll take it. The tree seems to say, a new slick leaf unfurling like a fist to an open palm. I'll take it all. Good morning again, everybody. It's good to see you all. I have a request that if it's possible for you to leave your camera on, it's wonderful if you're willing to do that. It gives us all a sense of community together. It's really lovely to see each other. And of course, if you've got something else going on, that you need to turn it off, please do. But if you can leave it on, it's wonderful. Thank you. I love that poem, and I find myself reading it every April quite a lot because it's just so beautiful. Instructions on not giving up. Despite the mess of us, the hurt, the empty, fine then, I'll take it, the trees seem to say. A new slick leaf unfurling like a fist to an open palm. I'll take it all. And isn't that a beautiful metaphor for what we do? We live in this life and find our way. So I think that I realize right now in this moment that I did not share with you what to expect this morning, our morning layout. So I'm going to offer now just some short Dharma thoughts, then we'll have a meditation, then we'll have a break, then I'll give a longer Dharma talk and we'll have plenty of time to talk with each other. So that's what we're up to this morning. So when I think of practice often in three parts: the ground, the path, and the fruit. And it's a nice framework for thinking about what we're up to and how to contextualize our practice. So when I think about the ground, this ground of what brings me to practice, and as I talk about this, I invite you to think about it for yourself. What is that driving force, that motivation? Maybe there's a sense of longing, a depth of longing that motivated you originally to come to practice. For many of us, what happens is we have a sense of maybe some not quite rightness, or maybe very obvious suffering, some sense that there's pain and there's hurt and we're looking for something to make us feel better. All of these things are true, mostly for all of us, that, or we have a sense that there's something bigger that we're connected to, and that can be that motivation, that ground. And I think that part of what happens as we tap into that place is that there is a sense of discovery, that we start getting to know ourselves, at least in my case, from the inside out. And we work on this internal awareness all the time, right? And then we couple that with the external awareness, and we start getting a sense of our place in our lives, in our small lives, meaning, you know, maybe our immediate home and how that connects to our community and the bigger community. So what is the ground of your practice? What is the ground of your life? What is that based on? And then that leads to the path, right? So the ground is our foundation that we are nurturing all the time. And the path or paths, the many paths, what are the efforts that we make that keep us going and support this unfolding? I think primarily what we are experiencing is this path of discovering our inner nobility. And I love that piece, that invocation to our meditation, O nobly born, you who are the sons and the daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. You mean that includes me? Wow, that includes me, that includes you, that includes all of us. I love the experience that we are nobly born, that we have a right to be here, to occupy this space. So I think the path is this path of discovery of our inner nobility. And through that, we experience everything. We experience the truth of impermanence, the truth of dukkha, the imperfection, the fundamental imperfection of life itself, or suffering. And through that, we discover the Four Noble Truths, and we discover the truth of karma, that there is a consequence to every action, that one thing is connected to the next, to the next, to the next. All the myriad causes and conditions that we are a part of. And I think part of this unfolding on the path that I've found, and I wonder for you too, it keeps broadening my perspectives. It keeps coming back to this question that says, what else is true? What do I know? What have I learned? And what else is there? There's this clarity of mind, we hope, that keeps developing. And I don't think this is linear, right? And I think many of us will know this. We may be on a roll and practice might be going really well, and then something shifts in our lives and we go down a different path, or we forget, or we get confused, or we just come into some potholes in our lives. But over time, we do have an expanding awareness as mindfulness takes a deeper and deeper root inside of us. And through that clarity of mind, I think what's happening is we have an expanding heart. And I remember early on, somebody said, you know, this is a practice of the open heart. And I thought, what's the open heart? What does that mean? Does that mean that I'm just wide open and I don't have any boundaries? I don't have any filters? I'm just here for whatever happens? And no, that's not what an open heart is. You know, the open heart is the heart that is willing to feel. The heart that is willing to feel, that can cultivate non-greed, non-ill will, clarity. But we tend to our hearts. This is part of this path. And as you know, my guess is that it's not easy work. And this is why it's called a path of purification, because we are learning to let go of what doesn't support us and cultivate what does. And so ultimately, in our liberation, in this awakening, what is left, I hope, what is left is our inner nobility. We've really tapped into that, and it supports us. It doesn't mean we're never going to make a mistake. It doesn't mean we're not going to cause unintentional harm. But we are learning over and over again to come from the kind heart. My intention, you know, when I think about motivation and intention for practice, I want to learn to live a wise, skillful life in which I don't cause harm to myself or anybody else. And mostly I think I don't cause intentional harm, but there are all kinds of ways of being that do cause some unintentional harm. And this practice shows us how that works on a more subtle level all the time. And so it takes this willingness, right? It takes this capacity to keep coming back over and over and over again. And there's a transformation that happens. But we have to be firmly in the stream, I think, for this to happen. This takes this quality of, okay, I'm there, I'm going to do it. And every time you come to Sangha, that is a reaffirmation and a recommitment, a dedication of your commitment to cultivating this clear mind and kind heart through wise and skillful action. Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote Braiding Sweet Grass, she says, transformation is not accomplished by tentative waiting at the edge. Transformation is not accomplished by tentative waiting at the edge. You know, I think that's true. There's a way in which we, at some point, we say, okay, I'm all in. I want this. I want to explore this. I'm going to do it. And then the fruit of the practice. What is the fruit of the practice? What have you learned? What's changed you? What have I learned? What's changed me? And I think I've shared in this class before that when anybody says to me, which is not infrequent, so you've been doing this a long time, Heidi, what are you getting out of it? And I think what is really happening is impulse control. That sounds really, really basic, but I think that's okay. Like the ability to pause, to try to see clearly what is happening here, that place right in between reaction or stimulus and response, transforming reactivity into responsiveness, decreasing suffering, increasing well-being. And so if I can cultivate the ability to wait, to think it over, I mean, all of these adages, right? You know, think it over, think before you speak, you know, all of that. It's actually true. It actually works. And I hope that you have found that too. Just a show of hands. Are you noticing that in your own practice that there's a little more impulse control? Yeah, it's beautiful. It's really helpful. And out of that, I think that seeing each other's inner nobility, seeing the goodness in one another, less quick to judge, less quick to judge, quicker to see, oh yeah, we all struggle. This is universal. One of the other things that's changed me and that I keep coming back to is that I'm trying to not be as analytical as I can be. Like always trying to figure out why. And there's a certain amount of stirring around when we always want to know, when I want to know, why is this happening? Why am I feeling like this, especially with difficulty? Like, you know, where is the suffering coming from? Because if I can just know why, then maybe it won't happen again. Well, that's true. You know, that I think that there's some truth in that. But I have also found that I can get really stuck in that place of trying to figure it all out instead of just being a little more open and allowing some space. And so the question that comes up that is helpful for me, in addition to the question that says, what else is true? Another way of asking the same question, instead of where's all this suffering coming from, going to where is it leading? Where is this suffering leading? And it's a beautiful question because that's the question in my experience that helps me keep the long view, keep a bigger perspective, and to make some wise, skillful, even creative decisions. And to trust the practice, to trust the process. That's the other part. And so it's not linear that we go ground, path, fruit, but these are the three components, I think. And we need each of them. We need to return to the ground of why we're here. We come back to the practices of the path all the time. And there are the fruits of our efforts that happen. They just happen. And so that's how we begin to trust this over and over and over again. There's a wonderful pithy Zen teaching, as many Zen teachings are, that says, when you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. I know that many of you have heard that before because I say it all the time. When you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. Is that not true? I mean, think about it literally. So that really encompasses ground, path, fruit. There's this wonderful story I heard a while ago about a woman who was in a memory care center. And as she aged and as her brain aged and she had less and less memory, ultimately she was left with only three words that she could speak. And the three words were precious, unexpectedly, and temporarily. So you could ask her any question and you might get one of those words: precious, unexpected, temporary. Temporarily or unexpectedly. Isn't that true? Life is precious. It is unexpected and it is temporary. What beautiful three words. So I love this poem, the very last few words that say, I'll take it all, because it requires a lot of us to have the courage to turn towards it, to say, I'll take it all. And where I live at the end of a dirt road, but the beginning of the road is the neighbors have paved it, and on either side of our lane, and it's really just a lane, I live in the country, they have planted 8 cherry trees on either side. So when we enter our road, we come down this aisle of these beautiful Akebono cherry trees. And this time of year, they are they're in full bloom, and it's extremely beautiful. And so this poem about here are all of the obscene display of cherry limbs, the greening of the leaves, the world's baubles and trinkets leave the pavement strewn with the confetti of aftermath, and the leaves come out. That's what's happening. And it's happening all around us, not just on my lane, but look around in springtime, and this is what is happening, and it's really beautiful. It's this rebirthing of the flowers, and then they drop, and then there's the next thing, the greening of the leaves. So last year when we were in the beginning of the pandemic and the cherry trees were in bloom, I was walking with a friend and we were in this conversation about like, where is this heading? And none of us knew where all of this was going a year ago. And we were coming into that place of staying home all the time. And is it okay to go for a walk with you? I think we can go for a walk. Just stand over there. And we were in that mode. And as we were coming down the middle of the lane with the cherry trees, there was a skywriter in the air, in an airplane. And he was drawing smiley faces up in the sky. And it turned out that he was doing it all over the county because he decided we all needed some cheering up. And it was just such a wonderful thing of, in the midst of the pain and the fear and the unknown, we can also still have the beauty. I'll never forget that. It was such a sweet moment of being in the midst of these cherry blossoms with this skywriting and these smiley faces above us. So to take in a little joy in the midst of it all, I'll take it all. And that brings me into a sense of this, the inner nobility of others, that person thought to do that, to cheer us all up. What a beautiful thing. And so can we see that in each other? So we'll talk more about that after our meditation. Well, welcome back, everybody. See if where we are with everybody coming back. Okay. I think we're about there. So in the Abhidhamma, which is the study of Buddhist psychology, which is this book, The Guide to the Universal Teachings of Buddhist Psychology, is Jack Kornfield's study of the Abhidhamma. There are many principles in this, and the very first principle in Buddhist psychology is to see the inner nobility of all beings. The Buddha famously said, "You can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself." Do you believe that? Maybe you do, maybe you don't, maybe not every day, but I hope for the most part you do, that you can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. Because we need to cultivate that in order to really show up in our lives, in our fullness, be present for others. It's not always easy, and it may not always feel accessible, but this is part of the direction that we're going. And when we see the inner nobility, the inner beauty of somebody else, it's actually stimulating the same place in the neural pathways in the brain that are activated when we feel that for ourselves. That kind of well-being. You can see beauty outside of yourself, that kind of appreciation, which leads to turning it towards ourselves too. This is the essence of metta practice, wishing well for others. We are included in that. We wish well for ourselves. But sometimes that can be really difficult. And we know that. It's not the same all the time. So how do we get there? You know, how do we get there? And so what I want to talk today about is confidence and trust and faith. Faith from the Buddhist perspective, which is confidence and trust, to decide to go in a certain direction. And I want to read you an excerpt from this book that I think is really, really, really is very beautiful. During a series of public teachings, the Dalai Lama stayed at a San Francisco hotel that was famous for hosting dignitaries. Just before he departed, the Dalai Lama told the hotel management that he would like to thank the staff in person, as many as wished to meet him. So on the last morning, a long line of maids and dishwashers, cooks and maintenance men, secretaries and managers made their way to the circular driveway at the hotel entrance. And before the Dalai Lama's motorcade left, he walked down the line of employees, lovingly touching each hand, vibrating the strings of each heart. Some years ago, there's a story of a high school history teacher who knew this same secret. On a particularly fidgety and distracted afternoon, she told her class to stop all their academic work. She let her students rest while she wrote on the blackboard a list of names of everyone in the class. Then she asked them to copy the list. She instructed them to use the rest of the period to write beside each name one thing they liked or admired about that student. At the end of the class, she collected the papers. Weeks later, on another difficult day, just before winter break, the teacher again stopped the class. She handed each student a sheet with his or her name on top. On it, she had pasted all 26 good things the other students had written about that person. They smiled and gasped in pleasure that so many beautiful qualities were noticed about them. 3 years later, this teacher received a call from the mother of one of her former students. Robert had been a cut-up, but also one of her favorites. His mother sadly passed on the terrible news that Robert had been killed in the Gulf War. The teacher attended the funeral where many of Robert's former friends and high school classmates spoke. And just as the service was ending, Robert's mother approached her. She took out a worn piece of paper, obviously folded and refolded many times, and she said, "This was one of the few things in Robert's pocket when the military retrieved his body." It was the paper on which the teacher had so carefully pasted the 26 things his classmates had admired. Seeing this, Robert's teacher's eyes filled with tears. As she dried her wet cheeks, another former student standing nearby opened her purse, pulled out her own carefully folded page, and confessed that she always kept it with her. A third ex-student said that his page was framed and hanging in his kitchen. Another told how the page had become part of her wedding vows. The perception of goodness invited by this teacher had transformed the hearts of her students in ways she might only have dreamt about. Nelson Mandela puts it beautifully. He says, "It never hurts to think too highly of a person. Often they become ennobled and act better because of it." Isn't that an amazing story? What a brilliant teacher for having the insight and courage in that moment to just say, "Okay, just stop. Just stop, everybody. And think about everybody who's around you. Make a list of everybody's names, and what do you notice? Say something good about them." And that teacher then made this list that stayed with people. I mean, how would it really feel if you were handed a piece of paper and 26 people had written something on there that they see your inner nobility? What would that do for each of us? And not only, I mean, receiving that would be such a tremendous gift, but what about the practice of doing it? What if we all actually took the time to think of a whole bunch of people who are in our lives and just wrote that down? I think it was a moment of brilliance. Desmond Tutu says, "It's far too easy to discourage, all too easy to criticize, to complain, to rebuke. Let us try instead to see even a small amount of good in a person and concentrate on that. Let us be quicker to praise than to find fault. Let us be quicker to thank others than to complain." And when we do this, not only are we strengthening the neural pathways in the brain that are responsible for feelings of well-being, and we are cultivating, strengthening what's called the confirmation bias and weakening the negativity bias. So we have the ability to notice the good easier than the automatic noticing what's wrong. We're strengthening that inside of us. But what we are also doing is strengthening our faith in our own inner nobility, in our goodness, in the goodness of each other. So the Pali word for faith is sadha, S-A-D-D-H-A, and it means, among other things, to place the heart upon. To place the heart upon, to go in this direction, this commitment to practice confidence and trust. And you know, it might not always be so easy. It's one thing to talk about it, and it sounds great, A lot of teachings sound wonderful, but when we get down to the nitty-gritty and where the rubber meets the road, sometimes it's not so easy, and we need each other to do this. So the way it's described in our Buddhist practice, there are four kinds of expressions of faith. And we'll talk about each of them. The four are bright faith, borrowed faith, verified faith, and abiding faith. So bright faith, what is that like? Do you remember the first time you came to perhaps a meditation class and you said, oh my God, this is for me. This is it. I found it. I remember that. Such a great feeling. It's like falling in love. There's some infatuation that happens with it. And we can get really single-minded that I'm all in. This is the way to go. We can even get evangelical about it. And you should do it too. And you should do it too. And you should do it too. But bright faith works in that way that it sparks something in us that keeps us growing and on this path and knowing, oh, this is something I belong to. This is what works. And it's good because even though the honeymoon comes to an end and we'll go through a cycle of, practice isn't so great anymore, we know what's possible and we can really tap into that. And it's a feedback loop, right? The more we do it, the more we learn, and we're cultivating something inside of us that strengthens our confidence and strengthens our trust. Rafe Martin is a Zen teacher, and he says, as a result of what happens when we practice and are in this bright faith period, maybe we step out again after that sitting a little lighter, a little steadier, a little happier, a little less heavily there, a bit more present here, and so a bit more capable of just a little more spontaneous kindness and generosity. So can it be just a little bit? You know, we start noticing what happens with the drip, drip, drip. It starts to get in us. And it's not this burst of all of a sudden I get it, but it is this drip, drip that, I just feel a little bit better. I have access to my heart in a little more, in more ways. Practice is supporting me. I have a little more impulse control, less reactive, all these things. So that's bright faith. And then the honeymoon ends, right? The infatuation starts to wear off and we think, oh, this is work. I guess this might just be work. Every time I sit down, I'm falling asleep. I want to meditate, but my back hurts, my knees hurt. I want to go cook something in the kitchen. I got other things I want to do. And we start losing our zip. And if that hasn't happened for you, my hunch is it will, that the practice goes in cycles. And I'm not aware of anybody who started out in practice and didn't go through some sort of circuitous way. I used to row a lot in a single scull near where I live on Humboldt Bay. And in my bright faith time, you can apply this to anything, but in my infatuation with rowing all the time, I was out early one morning and I said to a couple other rowers who were far more experienced than I was, you know, I haven't fallen in. And one of them looked at me and said, there are two kinds of rowers, those who have fallen in and those who haven't fallen in yet. And I was humbled and embarrassed at my lack of humility. And it wasn't long after that that I went down to the dock and I was getting in the boat and I fell right in, right at the dock. I didn't even get my butt onto the boat. And, you know, it just felt like one of those things, exactly. So then I needed to move into this phase of borrowed faith. Can I really do this? Can I really balance on that boat? Can I come back to practice when maybe I don't trust it so much anymore? So doubts arise, right? Doubts arise in whatever we're doing oftentimes. And we come back to, why am I doing what I'm doing? But there are two kinds of doubt, I think. Maybe there are more kinds of doubt, but I think they primarily falls into two different categories. One is the kind of doubt that paralyzes us. We can't make a decision. Something might happen. We fall off the boat and we say, I'm a terrible rower. I'm never doing that again. I forget it. I can't do it. And if you've ever had the experience of that, it's kind of a degrading, incessant doubt that keeps you from making a decision or going forward, even though you would like to. That's the kind of doubt that's kind of paralyzing. And Jan Martel, who wrote the book, The Life of Pi, this is what he says about it. He said, to choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation. And I think that says it really well, because we can have a habit of doubting ourselves, of doubting others, of doubting anything. We may have maybe something frightening, or we just have a certain inability to make a choice because of lots of habits, lots of conditioning. So to choose doubt as a philosophy of life, that could just be the habit of how we are, is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation. That's the paralyzing doubt that keeps us stuck. And then there's the other kind of doubt that I think is really useful, which leads us to investigation, to checking out things, to stimulating our curiosity. What am I not seeing here? What am I missing? What do you think? What do you think? I want to do this project. I'm interested in something, but I'm not sure. That's really exciting doubt, because that's the doubt that has got some energy behind it that moves us forward. Haikun, who was the great Zen poet, says, at the bottom of great doubt lies great awakening. So there's the different kinds. And he's also said, no doubt, no awakening, little doubt, little awakening, great doubt, great awakening. So we need to borrow some faith. So when that happens, that we lose our way, we lose our confidence, we come back to Sangha. We come back to others who are also in this practice. And we say, okay, I got to get reconnected. We keep showing up. You get back on the horse, you get back in the boat, and you do it in the company of others, because that's what supports us. The power of Sangha cannot be overstated, how much we really need each other. So here's a practice that also comes from Jack's book that I want to offer you. And so this is something that you can try that reinforces, I think, our trust and confidence and faith and our ability to see the goodness in others, the inner nobility. Here's what he says. Wait for a day when you awaken in a fine mood, when your heart is open to the world. If such days are rare, choose the best you have. Before you start for work, set the clear intention that during the morning, you'll look for the inner nobility of three people. Carry that intention in your heart as you speak or work with them. Notice how this perception affects your interaction with them, how it affects your own heart, how it affects your work. Then choose five more days of your best moods and do this practice on each of these days. Three people a day for another 5 days. After looking at three people a day in this way 5 times, set the clear intention to practice seeing the secret goodness for a whole day with as many people as you can. Of course, you will find certain difficult people, or certain people who are difficult. Save them for later and practice first with those whose nobility and beauty is seen most easily. When you've done this as best you can for a day, choose one day a week to continue this practice for a month or two. Finally, as you become more naturally able to see the secret goodness, expand your practice. Add more days. Try practicing on days that are more stressful. Gradually include strangers and difficult people until your heart learns to silently acknowledge and bless all whom you meet. Aim to see as many beings as you can with a silent, loving respect. Go through the day as if you were the Dalai Lama undercover. Go through the day as if you were the Dalai Lama undercover. What a great practice. I think we should all do it. And I'll be back next month and let's report back. See how it goes. See if you can remember to notice the inner nobility of others, 3 people a day, and start when you're in the best mood, right? And build up to, you can do it in any mood that you're in. And this is a different kind of metta practice. If you are familiar with metta practice, where we offer blessings to ourselves and then to somebody who is dear to us and then to a good friend and then somebody we don't know so well and then somebody who we find challenging and then to all beings, this is the same practice, but it's not done on the cushion. This is in the grocery store. This is in the parking lot, in the post office. And as we are getting out more, offering this kind of ability to see the inner goodness of others might help with, if you're feeling fear or trepidation about re-entering any kind of public spaces as we go through this time, give that a try. So that's a way that we work with cultivating confidence and trust, the borrowing of faith. We see the inner beauty of somebody else and it bolsters us, reminds us of our own goodness. The third kind is verified faith. So this is when we start finding our footing. We've been through the bright faith. We've been through, oh yeah, right, this month, I'm not really sure why I'm doing this. We go through that borrowed faith. Maybe even we're even loaning, offering our own faith to somebody else who's going through that phase. And then it starts to sink in. Then we start to say, oh yeah, I know those phases. And we move into this time of what's known as verified faith. And this is where something good is happening. This has started the fruit of the practice, the ground, the path, the fruit. And we come back to seeing that what the Buddha taught in his Kalama Sutta, where he said, find out for yourself. Don't just listen to other people. From your own direct experience, you will know what supports your well-being and what doesn't. What leads to non-greed, non-ill will, and clarity of mind, and what leads to greed, ill will, and ignorance. And do what supports your clarity, supports your non-greed, supports your non-ill will. This is how we can reinforce. This is how we verify our confidence and trust through our own direct experience. This is such a beautiful teaching that he said that. And that was one of the early teachings that really drew me into this practice, because when any teacher, mentor, elder, wisdom leader, thought leader says, I know you can do this. I trust you. That gives me an internal confidence because they see something in me that maybe I don't see. And so I am verifying my confidence through their eyes. That's what mentors do. So the Kalama Sutta that says, find out for yourself because I know you can do it, is brilliant. And there are a couple other ways to verify, to secure this. Abe Lincoln said, when I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That's my religion. So this is not very complicated, right? And we pretty much know the difference between good and bad, right and wrong. We do have an internal moral compass. It can get armored and covered over for some of us, but it is there. So when I do good, I feel good. And then I want to add, and then know what that actually feels like. Take it in, let it encode in your body, in your heart and mind. And when I do bad, I feel bad. Yeah, you know, let's stop doing what doesn't work for us, that causes harm, even if it's unintentional. Don't do it. And the Buddha gave us a beautiful compass question that says, what, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? It's a really great question. What, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? So that doesn't mean, you know, we don't only have, sometimes we just have short-term gratification in mind, and okay, that doesn't mean we don't do things that just make me feel good right now. Of course we do. But to also keep the long view, keep the big picture, that's another way to strengthen our confidence and trust. This is from Terry Tempest Williams' book called When Women Were Birds. In the arid foothills of the Wasatch Mountains, the Milky Way arched over us. It was the nightly path our eyes crossed before we went to sleep. This was my personal universe with its own inherent truths. Truth, for me, was based on what I could see and hear and touch and taste, more trustworthy than any religious doctrine. Rufous-sided towhees scratched in the understory of last year's leaves. Lazuli buntings were turquoise exclamation marks singing in a canopy of green. And blue-gray gnatcatchers became commas in an ongoing narrative of wild nature. My inspiration was winged. Magpies, evening grosbeaks, and scrub jays were family. Turkey vultures soared overhead, casting unexpected shadows during summer heat. Rattlesnakes were our complication to a life lived outside. We heard them, saw them second, coiled, and before we counted to three, we ran. Clouds became our focal point for change. One day, however, as I was sitting in our treehouse, I spotted a white bird perched directly above me. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen. I went into the house to call my grandmother, still watching the ghost bird through the glass sliding doors that faced the trees. I explained the size and shape of this mysterious bird to be that of a robin, only without a brown back, black head, and red breast. She listened carefully. We both had our books in hand. Perhaps it's an albino, she said, a bird without pigmentation, even its eyes without color. That very word, albino, was a revelation to me. She might as well have said, of the spirit world. It was indeed a robin, the most common of birds, free of its prescribed dressings, white with red eyes. I was inspired and called her the Holy Ghost. When I reported this finding to our local Audubon chapter as an 8-year-old bird watcher, the president said that because of my age, he could not legitimately count it as a credible sighting. My grandmother simply shook her head and said, "You know what you saw. The bird doesn't need to be counted, and neither do you." Now that is verified faith, right? We know what we saw. We know what we feel. We don't have to prove it to anybody. This is this kind of internal nobility, this inner nobility. We know, we grow to know who we are. So trust yourself. This growing confidence is critical. It's so important. And the last of these, abiding faith. This is the faith that is grown from practice, from experience, from wisdom and equanimity, and it becomes a continual resource for practice. So you know the story of Mara. Probably many of you do. Mara was the trickster in the time of the Buddha, the one who kept telling the Buddha, why are you trying to do this practice? What is all of this work around awakening anyway? Why do you think you deserve to become awakened? It's the voice of doubt. It's the inner critic. It's that piece of us that tries to get us off track. And it's a beautiful story about when the Buddha was sitting under the Bo tree for a week, deciding that he wasn't getting up until he understood the cause of suffering and the end of suffering. and knew there was a path leading to the end of suffering. But during that time, it's said that Mara kept coming and trying to dissuade the Buddha and tempt the Buddha with his beautiful daughters, with shooting him with arrows. And every single time one other of these distractions would come up, the Buddha would say, "Mara, I see you. Mara, I see you. I'm not afraid." And that was his commitment to waking up, to seeing through the delusions, to see the distraction, to see through the doubts, to trust deeply his own experience. So I think all of practice is about this expression of confidence and trust and faith to place our heart upon. And of course, it's not linear. You know, you can hear the phrases like crises of faith. I lost my trust. I lost my confidence. And that is a painful place to be. There's a place where we don't have our footing when we're in that place. And so we come back to Sangha. We start to trust that this practice can hold it all. We go back to the ground. We go back to the path. We start to see the fruits of our efforts and how we may come back into bright faith. Maybe you read a book that you hadn't read before, or like me, read this book a really long time ago, and I'm picking it up again because I need a little pick-me-up. You know, I need to be reminded. I need to be reminded. And that stirs up, enlivens that bright faith, and I borrow from it. This is how it works. None of this is linear, but it's such a beautiful practice that really holds us and helps us truly develop this inner nobility and the ability to see it with others and to come back to that piece that says you can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. And you start to not only believe it, but it starts to be the ground of your life. That as you understand this depth of self-love, we see it in others. We find it easily in others. And as we care for ourselves in deeper and deeper and kinder ways, and I don't mean fleeting indulgence. I mean really deeply caring for ourselves. I mean, you know, indulgence is great. I do love that. But that's not what I'm talking about. That we really do see that as we develop this deep care for ourselves, it's really easy to care for others. And sometimes it's easier to care for others, which then it comes back to us. And it's said that the Buddha's penultimate instructions as he lay dying, that he said, "Remember, all conditioned things are temporary. Whatever is of the nature to arise is of the nature to cease." And then he said, "Strive on with diligence." Strive on with diligence, which has also been translated as move into the future with confidence. You can do this. Move into the future with confidence. And sometimes that can be hard, right? I mean, we have this last year that we've all lived through that who knew where it was going, who knows where it is going. But can we move into the strive on with diligence? Just take the next breath. Just show up. That's what's required. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, just do two things. Begin and keep going. That's move into the future with confidence. So let's just pause for a couple minutes and then we'll talk with each other. Go inside. Let all these words just flow through, trusting that whatever is meaningful for you will stay. Whatever you don't need, let it go. Just sit quietly for a couple minutes.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.